It is God's will, and however hard it may be, we must think that he knows best. In the midst of life, we are in death. Goodbye. We pray that God will be very near you at this time and give you the peace that passeth understanding. The weather is very nice just now, so you must get out as much as you can. If you write stating that your husband died intestate, they will send you the necessary form to complete. May God bless and help you. Remember, my dear, that even as thy days, so shall thy strength be. I am writing to express our thanks for the 40 loyal years of service which he gave to our company. He was such a faithful servant to our organization. The board and staff join me in offering our very deepest sympathy in your sad loss. Whilst I should have liked to pay my respects by attendance at the service, I am afraid the timetable will prevent this. The end was so sudden, for which, I am told, you must be thankful. I am sure that God will be with you. God bless you.
Do you remember setting off early in the morning with baggage and raincoats and buckets and spades through the wet streets, grey as the slates, and the pointed coloured flags from yesterday's celebrations strung from window to window above the cobblestones, hanging limp and damp, red, white and blue. Do you remember? Then down to the railway station, hollow and echoing and dark and hushed in a way, except for the chant of the steam and the shriek of the whistle and the coupling pins clanking. Hushed in a way, but plenty of hustle and tickets and reading. All a strange world early in the grey morning. And then onto the train and the baggage humped on the racks. Slump on the seat and sink in the cushions as dust flies about. Waiting to go, watching people and porters pass by. Waiting to go to get away from it all. Waiting to go and then going. Out of the station, jerking and puffing, out of the dark and into the light, pulling away from the tangle of streets and the chimneys and the clock and the money, away from it all for a week, speeding past houses and land and roads and going on lines that lead to the sky and the sea.
Some good holidays then, when they were all little. It was the only place that Tom liked to go to.
I liked that rugged coastline and them sea breakers.
And the air did him good, different from the smoke and the dirt. It released his catarrh and he could breathe properly. And the sand was nice for the kiddies. Oh, and the grown-ups. It was always clean because the tide came right up. It stretched for miles and was smooth and clean. Oh, yes, Tom really did like Falcon's Bay. Small and quiet, just bigger than a village.
And the church clock striking eight.
A lovely little place. Not gaudy, but gay enough in its own way. And there was everything you wanted dotted about here and there. Nice mussels and oysters.
Yeah, for them that liked them. I liked them, but they didn't like me. Give me indigestion.
He preferred a crab once or twice for a tasty tea and Mrs. Jackson's rice puddings. He'd eat them till they came out of his ears. We always went to Mrs. Jackson's if we could get in there. We liked it there. She made you feel at home. She didn't overcharge and the sheets were always clean.
Mrs. Jackson, she's a fisherman's wife and she has three lads, all fishermen. Well, only two lads now because John, the middle one, he got lost in the war, the Second War. She likes to talk a lot, and you can't tell all she says sometimes. Different to her husband, he hardly talks at all. He's away a lot, fishing. Up early in the morning, and he's off. Sometimes she never sees him for weeks at a time. That's probably why she talks a lot, because he's away so much, and she's left on her own a lot. They happen don't bother with talking when they're out with the sea so much. He has his own little trawler now, but at one time, for a long time it was, Till he got some money together, he only had a rowing boat, a cobble, like the rest of the fishermen down on the landing there. In them days, him and his three lads took Tom's youngsters out fishing in the bay.
Tom never went fishing himself. He preferred the land. A deck chair on the beach, or a walk to Cliff Head over the slippery rocks, sniffing the salty seaweed and getting the sea air. That suited him best. That and a nice cup of tea. He was a one for his cup of tea. Nobody ever knew anybody like him. He got up early every morning to make a cup of tea in Mrs. Jackson's little long kitchen with the bright squared tablecloth and the long-legged stool. Mrs. Jackson was up at the same time getting the vegetables ready to feed all the visitors. Tom used to pull a leg a bit about making plenty of money, and he talked about the lads that had been killed in the war for no reason.
They make the wars and then they get somebody else's lads to fight them.
Somebody else's lads. Mrs. Jackson took in every word. And she often said, it's funny how they're all fishermen in her husband's family. His father before him was one, and his grandfather before that, and the father before that. Right back, they were all fishermen. And now her three lads, well, two lads now, are all fishermen. And now their lads are learning to be fishermen. All except John's two, the one that was lost. John's wife says if she has her way, her two lads will never go to sea at all.
They won't go for certain till they're 21. I'm their mother and I'll see to that. After they're 21, they can please themselves. It's out of my hands.
Listen. Up on the cliffs by the church, touching the sky and smelling the sea, watching the waves, washing the sand and weaving the rocks, flowing and ebbing, seeing the sun rising and feeling it warming and watching it flash on the water, making it glitter and glint, walking on the brown clay cliff path, taking the air and getting the breeze, green fields and cows grazing on one side, sheer drop to the sea on the other, sitting on a green form, watching below fishermen and boats and visitors in macks to keep off the spray and keep out the chill, walking and turning and passing the woman and dog, strolling along and nodding a greeting, not stopping, just nodding, and walking along to the end of the world, watching the waves and pausing to listen, the sound of the sea. Listen.
Wake up! Wake up, for God's sake, wake up! Do you think we've gone through the slush and the stench of the trenches to see this? To see this, another bloody war? There's no glory in war, we know. We've seen it, like thousands of others. There's only one way to stop wars. Get the men round the table who fought the wars. The men who fought with a bayonet. The men who went over the top. The men who came back. And the men who never came back at all. Never forget them. The men who were slaughtered for no reason. The men who died in the mud and the muck. What about them? Wake up, for God's sake!
Mrs. Jackson thinks like Tom did, and so does John's wife.
It's all right saying they died for king and country, but they didn't. They went because they had to go. They didn't want to go, most of them anyway. Like my husband, John, he didn't need to go. But after seeing what he did, he knew he had to. His mother knows that.
Oh, I do. I'll never forget that day when I heard that he'd gone and volunteered. I had him in the little long kitchen and I asked him what he wanted to go and volunteer for. He should have waited till they sent for him. They send for you soon enough when they want you. He was married as well, but he would go. Him and a lot of other lads round about went together. Now, what set him off for going was seeing some seamen washed up in a boat down on the beach just after the war had started. The ship had been sunk by a submarine and they were washed up in a lifeboat down on the beach. Still warm they were, and their backs full of bullet holes. One seaman had both his eyes out. It must have been an awful sight. They must have all crouched down in this lifeboat and all these bullets had gone into their backs. That's what set John and the others off about joining up, seeing them seamen like that. I'll always remember our John that day when he came into that little long kitchen. I'll always remember. He said, if I could get hold of one of them men that did it to them seamen, I'd murder them. He'd murder him, he said. But in the end, it was them that murdered John, wasn't it? They murdered him.
They did. And he didn't have to go and join up. Fishermen didn't have to go, not at that time. We needed the fish for food. They didn't have to go, but they went, after seeing them seamen like that.
Tom was born in the Golden Valley, as they call it, because the hills turn gold in autumn. He was the eldest of five children, and when his father was killed in a fall when he was out building, his mother had to take in lodgers to keep a roof over their heads. One of the lodgers couldn't pay his rent and he did a moonlight flit, and in his hurry he left a book behind. Tom picked it up and read it and learned. When he was 19, he left the Golden Valley and went to work down south.
He was doing very well, but then the war broke out, the first war, and he was called up into the army. He didn't want to go, but he had to. Tom always blamed his guitar on the war when he was gassed. His nose was stuffed up for the rest of his life, and every so often he had violent sneezing attacks. They lasted for days at a time. He was gassed, and then he was wounded in the leg when he went over the top and shipped home to hospital in England. They never got all the shrapnel out, and he walked with a bit of a limp for the rest of his life. Although that never bothered him. It was just this guitar in his head.
And I couldn't smell flowers because it set me off sneezing for days at a time.
After the war, he didn't go back to work down south, but went back to the north, near to the Golden Valley. He got a job with a new firm. Tom never got on very well there, really, not for money, but he stayed there for 40 years. In the Golden Valley, they always said what a nice job Tom had. He was a pen pusher, nice pay and nice hours, and going to work in a collar and tie. But they didn't know that Tom and his wife had to scratch and scrape many a time to keep decent.
And he didn't get paid nowhere near what people thought he did. Some of the men in the mills and the factories got a lot more money.
Money, money, money. Money isn't everything.
Money isn't everything. But you can't go and tell the shopkeeper that when you want a loaf of bread or a packet of cigarettes. Just look at the shopkeeper and say money isn't everything and see what he says. No, in some ways Tom would have been better off staying at home in the Golden Valley in the mill. He could have earned a lot more money.
Money, money, money. But at least what I did get paid was regular. There was always something there every week. And don't forget, it was a regular wage coming in all through the slump when most men were walking the streets hungry and looking for work. Don't forget that.
This way for the footpath to the 12th century parish church, up on the cliffs. This way, all seats free. Down by the old whitewashed cottages and over the bridge across the ravine. The ravine leads down to the sea and it has trees and bushes on either side, throwing a shadow forever. And there is the sound of the sea in the distance and the rustle of the leaves and the squawk of birds in the trees. The same music in the shadows and a crack of light from the sky through the overhanging branches. Alone up the pathway, quiet and cool, a creaking iron gate and grass overgrowing the graves. A man in a cap and a tight-fitting jacket from round by the back of the church, with shears in his hands, and a look on his face, startled at having his secret revealed, and a look in his eyes, frightened or furtive. Let's find Billy Gull's grave.
Billy Gull, he was a Piero, and he wore a pointed hat with three black bobs on it. His gravestone's like that, a pointed Piero's hat with three black bobs on it. If you can find it, it's round about somewhere. He gave a show three times a day down on the sands, morning, afternoon and night, on this little plank platform down on the sands. It never used to rain in them days, not like it does now. Mrs. Jackson thought the world of Billy Gull.
Everybody did. Everybody remembers him. He started off with nothing. He hadn't a penny. He was a street singer, singing in the streets, and he finished up by buying electric cinema.
In them days, down on the sands, he sang comic songs and got all the kiddies singing. Then he'd get some of them up front to sing and give them all a bag of sweets or a balloon. It was different to what they have today. They've tried to make it better and improve things, but have they? It was more seaside in them days than it is now. Oh, Billy Gull had made a good parson. He'd all those comic songs at his tongue end. Him and two other fellows that helped him had to cart this piano down to the sands every morning and then back again at night up this big hill. Can you just see him now, pushing this big piano up this steep hill on a cart? Over my shoulder goes one care.
Over my shoulder go two cares. Why should I cry? It's blue above, and I'm free at last, and I'm in love. Over my shoulder goes three cares. Over my shoulder go four cares. Bye-bye to trouble, it's got me on recall. Over my shoulder goes it all. Dance.
Over my shoulder. Mrs. Jackson hardly ever goes down to the sands these days. Not since Billy finished. She went down often when Billy was performing. His grave's round about somewhere.
Mrs. Jackson, she reckons that every 20 years there's a fella comes along that wants a war.
First one, then another, and now there's this fella, whoever he is. But I'm not frightened now. Not like I was in last war. They can do what they like with me. I don't care. I don't care. They can blow me to kingdom come, and that's it. That's just how I feel. I don't care. I'm like that. I'm like Tom was. I've no time for kings and queens. I'm not a communist, but I don't see why I should help to keep kings and queens and their families. And I want to know this. I want to know why their kiddies should get all that money every year, thousands of pounds, while our John's little lad, like thousands of other little lads whose fathers were lost in war, was only entitled to 11 shilling a week. That's all his mother got for him when our John was lost. 11 shilling a week. It doesn't seem right somehow.
Comedian down in the Sun Pavilion nowadays. He's very good. You have to laugh at him just to see his face when he's telling them jokes.
So anyway, there's this woman, and I see her every Monday, like, sat in the doctor's surgery. Anyway, she wasn't there last Monday, so the following Monday I said to her, I said, where were you last Monday, love? So she says, I couldn't come, I wasn't well. Anyway, then this woman, she came in, and she could hardly walk, poor lass. I says to her, hey, love, I said, you better take my place. I said, it's my turn now, but you go on in, go on, I said, take my place. Well, she was in a right bad way, she could hardly walk. Anyway, after a couple of minutes, she came out right as rain, walking as straight as you were. Me, aye, not wrong with her at all. What a transformation! What a transformation! So anyway, I went into the doctor. And I says, by gum, doctor, I says, you did a marvellous job on that woman that's just been in. I said, it's marvellous job, marvellous. How did you do it? Oh, he said, it were nose. He said, nothing at all, really. All she'd done, she'd put both her legs in one side of her nipple. Well, you do, girls, don't you? Especially when you're there, eh?
He's good as this comedian, but he's not like Billy Gull was, somehow, in them days.
There's nobody dead. Only the headstones are dead, ugly and dull, and their messages chipped in the stone with a hammer and chisel. There's nobody dead, only the headstones. The grass is growing, the soil is rich, and voices are whispering whispers up in the air, not under the ground. The air is whispering and the sky is light and the sound of the sea is swashing and swaying and the leaves on the trees rustle in the wind blowing in from the sea. The light is clear and the way is light and the salt in the air and the smell of the earth and the trees and the green leaves and the grass and the shadows and the sound of the sea and the wind in the leaves. Listen.
Corporal Tom Ramsden, 41, has been killed on active service. Corporal Ramsden, whose father was killed in the last war, leaves a widow and two children. Gunner T. Finch, wounded on May the 29th last, has not been traced since. Private George Edwards has been killed in action. He was aged 20. He was one of the first members of the 2nd and 3rd Northeast Boy Scout Troop. Ordinary Seaman Sidney Winter has been taken prisoner after his ship had been sunk. His brother, Ronald, was killed in France last year. Fred, another brother, is serving as a forces in the East. Petty Officer A. E. Giles has been awarded a DSM for bravery at sea. Seaman Norris Feather has been reported missing. He is 32. His mother would be pleased to have news from his friends. He is her only son. Driver Rodney Smith, 25, is reported to be a prisoner of war. His father was killed in the last war. RAF Sergeant G. Browning has been reported missing. He was in the church choir. Official notification has been received that leading air craftsman James Ashton, 21, has died from wounds in Malta. Gunner Fred Grayson, RA, has been wounded in the Middle East. Before joining up, he worked at the power station. The Reverend John Robert Jones is reported missing, presumed killed.
Dear Tom, the cheering is over and the flowers are dead. But may the flowers of humanity still live on. As we have discussed many times when we have all met on our annual holidays at Falcons Bay, there should be a World Council of ex-servicemen to make sure that there are no more wars. Let the men who met the enemy at the point of the bayonet now meet together over a friendly table and discuss plans for a lasting peace, so that, as one great man once said, our prospects will brighten on the influx of better thoughts. Every day, I pray that the Lord will give us peace for the sake of our children and their mothers. I pray that men are given the strength of thought that casts all wars away, and as their children and grandchildren grow up, let us try and make them brothers and teach them to be men of peace instead of war. Forgive me for writing so, but as an old man, I look back on a life that has been filled with wars and the fears of wars. Boys who I've watched grow up into men have been wrecked or lost before their work has barely begun. However, I do not need to tell you this, as you know only too well about these tragedies. We look forward to enjoying your company at Falcons Bay for many more years to come. Perhaps you may be able to get over for a cup of tea someday before then. In any case, look after yourself.
In Mrs. Jackson's front room, there's a pricked rug which she bought from Mary Jane. It was when Mary Jane lived in Falcons Bay and married this chap that had a little pony and trap. They used to go clip-clopping through the streets every Sunday morning in this pony and trap. He only had one leg, but he was a nice fella. A cobbler he was. He'd do anything for Mary Jane. To say he had a caught leg, he was always cheerful, and all the people round about respected him. Mrs. Jackson remembers him well. He mended all their shoes for them. Mary Jane was Tom's cousin. She was born in the Golden Valley near where Tom was born. She was brought up by their Aunt Alice after her father, young Jim Ashworth, had gone off to America to seek his fortune while Mary Jane was still a baby. He was supposed to have sent for his wife and Mary Jane when he got settled down, but since that morning when he left home, nobody from the village had ever heard of him again. His wife died of a broken heart, so Aunt Alice was left to look after Mary Jane. She had to work hard, but they were good to their workers in the Golden Valley in them days. Down that road at 6 every morning and back at 6 every night for 12 shilling a week, and a day trip to Blackpool every year at the firm's expense, and a golden sovereign from them when you were 21. To say Aunt Alice never had any help, she did a good job with Mary Jane, and she grew up to be a big, strong lass, a bit headstrong, but frightened of nobody, an hard worker if ever there was one. Then when Mary Jane was 21, she got married to Jacob Bobbs. He was a fine-looking fella, but he joined the Masons and took to drinking a lot. There's many a time he'd come home drunk and knock Mary Jane about a bit. And then they had a little boy, but he died from diphtheria while he was still a baby. And Jacob Bob's got to drinking terrible, so in the end Mary Jane left him and she went right away and he went back to live with his mother. Year after the first war broke out and Jacob Bob's had to join the army. First time he was home on leave, he went to see Aunt Alice, and he said he was sorry for all what he'd done to Mary Jane, and to tell her himself he was sorry. But Aunt Alice couldn't give him the address, because nobody knew where Mary Jane had got to. So Jacob Bobbs went back off leave, and soon after he was killed, fighting in France.
Going on the beach, the sand's yellow, brown, golden, shining wet from the sea going out, buying the deck chairs at sixpence a time, and finding a spot where it's not too hot or too windy, just right, under the prom wall or the other side of the changing tents. Taking it easy, stretching and dozing, and seeing the sights of legs and braces and kids and dogs shouting and barking and smiling and laughing and singing and fighting. Fetching the tea in a jug from the calf on a tray, going careful but spilling it over the top and into the sugar, but it tasted very good just the same. Having a walk down the side of the sea, seeing mums paddle in bloomers and watching the donkeys and ponies carrying the kids and keeping them happy, earning their keep. Smoking and chatting with people behind who came on the same train, looking better and fitter than they did then. Thank goodness it's doing them good. Sitting and waiting. The tide's coming in till it comes right in and catches you sitting, flooded out. But it doesn't matter, as Billy Gull used to say.
Billy Gull, he should have been a parson. Tom often said him and Billy could show the parsons how to fill their churches.
Yeah, full of old soldiers as well. They want to get their heads out of the clouds and come down to earth a bit more. That's where we need the parsons, down on earth, putting some fire in their sermons and thumping the pulpit a bit more.
He did carry on about it sometimes. Sometimes folk didn't think he was right in his head. He never went to church, but he'd have made a good parson. He got on very well with one parson. Every Tuesday night, him and this parson and two other fellows went out for a drink. And when he come back, he often said that the parson had paid his round with threepenny bits. Where did he get all of them from? Oh, he got on very well with that parson, different to the one that came after. Every time Tom saw him, he had an argument with him about religion. Sometimes Tom come home with his nose red raw and his eyes streaming and sneezing his head off. He'd happened got too near some flowers growing at the side of the pub's bowling green, and this had set him off sneezing.
But often he came home and told a tale about when he was in the trenches, and a message came from headquarters to send back that pen pusher immediately. The sergeant in charge didn't like it. Big beefy fella he was. He said to Tom as he was leaving the trenches, "Silly bleeders for luck."
"Ah, and it'll be silly bleeders that'll come out of this lot alive, sergeant. Ta-da!"
Other times, on a Tuesday, he'd happen come home full of fire and fury, spitting blood about the government not doing right to the lads that fought in the war. And when he was getting older, he came home much quieter, sickened to death because he could see another war. All them lads lost in the trenches, for nothing.
Oh, it's sickening. Wars, wars, wars. If you didn't have a laugh now and again, you'd go off your rocker.
"There's this pal of mine who's a doctor. So I said to him one day, I said, 'You must be very clever to be a doctor. Very clever.' I said, 'How do you do it?' I said, 'I mean, how do you know what to give people and tell them what to do to get better? Very clever you must be, doctor.' I said, 'Very clever.' 'Oh, no,' he says, 'not really. It's very simple, very simple. Anybody could do it. Anybody,' he said. So anyway, he says, 'Why don't you come round with me and I'll show you just how simple it is.' Anyway, I went with him on his round and we got to this house and we went to see this patient. Lovely old woman she was, in bed. Without ever asking the doctor, he said, 'The trouble with you is, my dear, you're eating too many sweets and too many chocolates. Cut them out,' the doctor said, 'and you'll get your weight down in no time. You'll feel a right lot better.' Anyway, when we got outside, I said to this doctor, I said, 'Marvellous, marvellous, doctor, how did you do it?' He said, 'It were easy,' he said, 'easy. All I did was I used my eyes,' he said. 'When I went in,' he said, 'I saw all these toffee papers and chocolate wrappers under the bed, so I knew what the trouble was straight away.'
Oh,
anyway, I said to the doctor, I said, 'Is that all you did?' He said, 'Aye, that's all. It's like I told you. It's very easy,' he said, 'very easy.' Anyway, we got to the next house. He said to me, he says, 'Look,' he says, 'you go in on your own,' he said, 'and tell the patient that you're my assistant. All you have to do is keep your eyes open,' he said. 'Remember that. Just keep your eyes open,' he said. 'You'll see for yourself just how simple it is.' So anyway, I went in, and when I came out, the doctor said to me, he says, 'Well, how did you get on then?'
The anchor's cast. They're back at last.
Mrs. Jackson said one woman they had in got stuck in the bar.
She was a big woman. I heard this shouting, went upstairs to the bathroom, and there's this woman couldn't get out of the bath. Poor lass.
Then you had that man that couldn't shave himself, could hardly get his breath.
Oh, he put whiskey in his tea. He was a good laugh, though. He used to be a miner down the pit. But his lads aren't going down, not if he can help it.
Well, can you blame him? I can't.
I thought you must be off it when you said you didn't want any fish and chips.
I'd love you to come round for a cup of tea. If you know it, Pete Wright, dear.
Hey, we've been lucky with the weather.
She sits up on that bench near the memorial with her son's name on it.
Come here, come here. If you don't come here, I'll brain you.
Hey, you should never have been a fisherman's wife. You have no patience.
These big fellas walking past this window, I don't know, they must take some feeding.
Drink it while it's hot.
It's doing us good. We mustn't grumble.
We couldn't have a better week than this.
Giving the tickets out at the door of the Sun Pavilion is Harry, an old-age pensioner. He might be a keen youngster, trying to make a big impression in his first job the way he dashes round and looks after the customers. The other night, he left his post to dash round to the cafe. He came back with a small box of chocolates for one of the girl singers. She said, "Oh, you shouldn't have. You didn't have to do this." And he said, "Go on, I want you to have it." And then he rushed, humpbacked, back to his post. One night he said, "If you come early tonight, don't sit on those plush seats at the back. They're for the councillors. They'll only shift you." "Oh, yes, Harry knows. Mrs. Jackson will tell you."
"Oh, yes, Harry. He married my cousin.
Yes.
I've had a bit of trouble with the councillors myself. The road up our street had been nothing but rubble and dirt for years, and in the end we all had to pay for this road being done ourselves. £61 each it cost us, and them in Bottom House had to pay over £100. At first the council told us it was going to cost £90 each. We got this letter affair from the council, all of us, you know, a right long form wanting all particulars. Well, we all got together and we said we weren't going to pay all that money. Anyhow, we called a meeting with the council. Of course, there was only a few of us went in the end. But anyway, the few that did go said they weren't going to pay all that money. We could get it done ourselves a lot cheaper. Jacuzzi at the top house, he's a builder. He could have done it. But the council said they couldn't do that. They were the masters, they said, and they'd have to do it. Anyhow, in the end, it only cost us £61 each.
He, this comedian, you have to laugh sometimes.
So I went in, and when I came out, doctor said, "Well, how did you get on then?" So I says to him, I says, "Well, it were very easy." I said, "Very easy." I said, "I just went in, and there's this old woman in bed." So I said to her straight away, I said, "The trouble with you is, love, you've been overdoing your church work, doing too much at it. You'll have to cut it down a bit, love, and you'll be fit again in no time." Anyway, doctor looked at me, he said, "Very good, very good," he said, "but how did you know?" So I told him, I said, "Well, I just kept my eyes open like you said, doctor." So he said, "Well, how did you know she was overdoing the church work?" So I said, "Well," I said, "there were vicar under bed." So, well, I knew. Oh, it were easy. Well, you do, girls, don't you?
Soon after Mary Jane got married to this chap with a cork leg in Falcons Bay, she began pricking rugs and selling them. She sent for felt from the mill in the Golden Valley where she worked as a girl, and then cut it up in strips and made pricked rugs. She did very well at it, and it wasn't long before she had women working for her. But then this chap with a cork leg and the pony and trap, he died from a stroke, and as soon as she'd cleared up all his affairs, she went back home to live in the Golden Valley. How she got caught up with Ted Roberts, nobody knows for rights. He was her third husband. Anyway, she did, and soon after Aunt Alice died, she married him and took his three lads on as well and bought this house halfway up the hillside. Mary Jane was strict with them three lads, but they couldn't have had a better mother. And when they all got working and bringing good money in from the mill, she made them save so much a week for their holidays and so much for when they got married. She was very good-natured. There was always plenty to eat on her table. It was either pies and peas straight from the chip shop in a pot bowl, or a big plate of boiled ham with mustard, plenty of bread and butter. Not margarine, always butter, and a mug of tea. Even in wartime, her pantry was chock full of stuff. How she got it all, nobody knows. She'd a way with her. She kept her house clean and tidy, especially her front room. The sun shone through the window and everything was spick and span and smelled of furniture polish. And round the walls there were oval plate pictures of Ted Roberts's best racing pigeons. But nobody was hardly ever allowed in her front room. They lived in the back kitchen with a black-leaded fireplace and the hills that were always grey and misty looming up from the window. Mary Jane often sat at that back room of her nights pricking rugs like she did when she was in Falcons Bay. She pricked away and the hills through the window got darker and quieter, and the neighbours walked up and down the flagstones and the little back streets in their clogs, or went out into their little backyards with their shawls on to the dustbins near the little stone washhouses. The last time Tom went there was in August, near the end of the war. Between then and Christmas, Ted Roberts's three lads was all killed, fighting in the war. Just after Christmas, Tom got a letter from Ted Roberts to say that Mary Jane had been taken poorly. Then in February, Pancake Tuesday it was, a telegram boy stopped outside Tom's house. When Tom came home to his dinner, he read the telegram.
Mary Jane, who's gone before me, poor lass.
Going along, and the train wheels rolling, rumbling, rolling. Remember, remember, rumbling through the rolling hills, hollow and hushed. Grey slates and green hills and chicken runs and bubbling streams and streaming rivers, lumbering, humming, steaming, hissing. Remember, remember, waiting in the dark, lonely station, hollow in the hills, safe in the stone, holy and heavy. The wind and the rain, stealing time, over the tops, top of the hills, wind howling, pelting rain. Do you remember? Tom always said, learn all you can, lad. Get it in your head. Then nobody can take it away from you. What you've learned and got in your head, nobody can take away from you. They might try, but they can never stop you thinking. What's in your head is yours, and nobody can take it away from you. Learn all you can, lad, and work hard. That's what he said.
When the Second War came, he dug a trench in the garden like they did at the front in the First War. He helped to get the local fire party going. He wouldn't allow the elder son to volunteer for the war. He made him wait till they sent for him. There's no glory in war. He knows. He saw it. And all his life, Tom was a right Labour man. He'd more arguments about politics than anything else. In them days, he said there'd always be wars as long as the Tories were in power. It's the big money men that start wars. It's good for business. After the war, he was like a dog with two tails when Labour got in power. But he changed. It was all that money squandered and thrown down the drain that upset him. That's what he said. I said he expected too much. He expected paradise, all at once, like a man in a dream. But he wouldn't have it. And in that election, just before he died, he voted for the Tories. It was the first time in his life that he hadn't voted Labour. Just after that he died from a stroke. Coronary thrombosis, the doctor called it. Anyway, he died.
Carrying the coffin down the main street of the village, an old village of crumbling bricks and whitewashed passages and solid flag roofs and pies and peas in pot bowls and shawls and clogs, the forebearers, big and strong, and bell-ringers. Hammer that bell, hammer it well, ring out the message that contradicts hell. On to the big black church on top of the turnpike, facing the valley of slates and chimneys and mills, the Golden Valley, and the bleak, barren, open hills, and the church black and cold and respectable, and the people around looking respectable in their black, and a good boiled ham tea waiting at the co-op in the room upstairs, specially booked, with apple pie and custard to follow.
Many of us went through blood, stench and hell together. We came back hoping for a better world full of grateful people to work out the peace of the world for all time. I believe we've been misunderstood. I don't think we've ever had a hearing. And yet we have this consolation, that we did a man's job in the hope that a better world would result. Those that live must carry on the fight for peace, for unless that aim is achieved, there is no hope for anybody in any nation. Throughout my lifetime, I've learned that the better things come through perseverance. We must all work together and keep faith with God and the men who've fallen in wars with the cross on their breasts, so that we might lead a fuller life on earth as God intended. They hope they are fighting for a better world, but this better world is yet to be. It's up to everybody to keep on persevering for it, to keep their heads well up, fight the good fight, and be of good cheer. And in the twilight of their days, they will have no need to regret that their time has been wasted. For a better world, we must will it, pray for it, work for it, and then it will be given to us.
It's funny how Tom always said he could show the parsons how to fill their churches. At the service at the church in the city, before they took him over the tops to bury him in the graveyard that overlooked the Golden Valley, the parson said he'd never known the church as full all the time he'd been there. Tom always said he could show them how to fill their churches, him and Billy Gull. Might have seemed a lot of talk, but but he was right in the end.
P.S. I myself thought a great deal of him, and of course she did. I never thought that when he shook hands with me and said goodbye, it was for the last time. That is the greatest tragedy in our lives, to lose the ones we love. We cannot, and indeed we have not the power to understand the mind of our Creator, though in numerous ways he gives us strength to bear our ills and comfort us. I don't know what induced me to go to the library and look up the paper on that Saturday morning, and I could hardly believe it when I saw your sad news. I went at once to the post office, and when I came home, I had to break the news to her gradually, for, as you know, she is in a poor way.
The fishermen walking down to the boats, walking steadily, surely, with the beat of their long rubber boots soft and firm, taking them back to the sea. The fishermen in their blue jerseys and flat caps, baiting their lines and their nets, winding and coiling with patience, with their faces leather-brown, beaten and battered and humble, but strong and quiet and firm. The fishermen with their pints and their pipes, rosy and roguing and spinning a yarn, with their broad shoulders walking through the streets at dawn, as big and as broad as the houses. The fishermen with their grey hair and still going out to sea. Tom went in the pubs at night when the kids were tucked in their attic beds safe under the red tile roofs of the seaside. He preferred to go round to Tom Slater's. He knew quite a few in there, fishermen and comics, and Billy Gull, and he had a chat and that, while a piano jangled in a jungle of pints and smoke and voices of residents and holiday-makers, mostly all sunny-side up. He liked a bit of life, not too much, just an hour or so, to get away from the routine of the kids for the rest of the day.
Well, it was a bit of a trail up and down them steps, twice and three times a day, to Mrs. Jackson's for our meals, with the kids scampering and falling, tired and crying. But it was worth it in the end, looking back, and it did his catarrh good.
Still looking for Billy Gull's grave, Hilda Mary Thompson, may there be no more moaning at the bar when I put to sea. In Jesus' keeping, David, aged 2½. Sometime, someday, we'll understand.
Mrs. Jackson said they went to that place down south for the unveiling of that Seaman's Memorial last month, her and their John's wife.
They have all the names engraved on plaques. It cost us £20 to go. We had to stay all night. It's such a long way. John's name's on it, right next to his pal that went with him. One woman said her son's name should have been on it as well, but these plaques are only there for them lads that didn't have a grave. These plaques are only there for them lads that were lost, like John.
But it's like Tom said, not all of them get recognised, like my son-in-law. Now, he was badly injured helping to put a fire out on the railway station during a blitz. He was a porter, and him and another fellow was on duty that night, and they both got badly burned putting the fire out. But they put it out and saved a lot of stock. But the man who got the medal for it was the station master, and he was off duty that night. So where do you go from there?
Do you remember when I first came of Falcons Bay with John before we were married? We had a walk round through the town, the sun was shining, and we walked down a white curving road. At the end of the road, we went over the railway crossing and turned left by the station. The station master was in his shirt sleeves working in his flower bed. And then we walked through the town streets where the women were shopping and gossiping. We passed the old fishermen's whitewashed cottages with green door and went down the winding stone steps to Joe's tea wagon on the seafront. Joe was a fat man with a red face and a bald head, and his wife called him Johnny. I remember I didn't like to look at him when he talked because his teeth were nearly black. We had a cup of tea, me and John, and waited till the tide was right out. Then we walked on Cliff Head and watched four small boys catch three little green crabs. We watched the sea, and I wondered what all the fishes were doing. And then suddenly a great black cloud came over the sun and a gust of wind blew up, and John said we'd better get back before the rain came. We sheltered at his house and then I stayed the night. When I were in bed and it was all still, I heard a steam engine cuff through the railway station at the end of that white curving road. I remember. Falcons Bay was growing on me like a new tune. and I never dreamt of what was to come. Sometimes it only seems like last week since that first day. Other times it seems like 100 years.
Early in the morning, through the quiet, salty streets, past the fish shop and the butcher's, get your sausages here, fresh cut, for breakfast, the postman and the picture house, and just one or two people and the woman and the dog in the quiet, clean streets, and the church clock striking 8.
This scroll commemorates Seaman J.W. Jackson, Royal Navy, held in honour as one who served king and country in the World War of 1939-45 and gave his life to save mankind from tyranny. May his sacrifice help to bring the peace and freedom for which he died.
It's framed on the wall in Mrs. Jackson's front room, where Mary Jane's prick drug still is.
And for God's sake, pray that there'll be no more bloody wars.
Shadows from the sun and the clouds sweeping across the rocks and pools on Cliff Head. Feeling the sea and the salt and the sky through the nose. Seeing the patterns of the rocks smoothed and shaped by the sea. Sniffing the seaweed and tasting the fresh, clean taste of nothing, just for a second. And the woman sat on the rock with a scarf round her head, as she was at the mill a long time ago. He's gone now. You can't see him now. But he's there somewhere, searching and watching. The call and echo and fade to the sky. Listen.
Trouble, it's gone beyond recall, and over my shoulder goes it all.
In It Never Rained in Them Days by Norman Smithson, Robert Wallance played Tom and Violet Carson his widow. Marion Dawson was Mrs. Jackson, Juliet Cook, John's wife, and Harry Markham, the old man. Bert Gaunt played Bill and the comedian, and Henry Livings was the narrator. The play was directed in Leeds by Alfred Bradley.